The Slanderer by Anton Chekhov, adapted by Nicholas Melbrew from the translation by Herman Bernstein, and read by Michael Robert Brown. Sergei Kapitonich Akinyeev, the teacher of calligraphy, gave away his daughter Natalia in marriage to the teacher of history and geography, Ivan Petrovich Loshadinich. The wedding feast went on swimmingly. They sang, danced, and played in the parlour. Waiters, hired for the occasion from the club, bustled about hither and yon like madmen in black frock coats and soiled white neckties. A loud noise of voices smote the air. From the outside, people looked in at the windows. Their social standing gave them no right to enter. Around midnight, the host Akinyeev made his way to the kitchen to see whether everything was ready for the supper. The kitchen was filled with smoke from the floor to the ceiling, the smoke itself pungent with the odours of geese, ducks, and many other dishes. Victuals and beverages were scattered about on two tables in artistic disorder. Martha, the cook, a stout red-faced woman, was busying herself near the loaded tables.
"Show me the sturgeon, my dear,"
said Akinyeev, rubbing his hands and licking his lips.
"What a fine aroma! I could just devour the whole kitchen. Well, let me see the sturgeon."
Martha walked up to one of the benches and carefully lifted a greasy newspaper. Beneath that paper, in a huge dish, lay a big, fat sturgeon, amid capers, olives and carrots. Akinyeev glanced at the sturgeon and heaved a sigh of relief. His face became radiant, his eyes rolled. He bent down and, smacking his lips, gave vent to a sound like a creaking wheel. He stood a while, then snapped his fingers for pleasure and smacked his lips once more.
"Aha! The sound of a hearty kiss! Whom have you been kissing there, Marfusha?"
Someone's voice was heard from the adjoining room. And soon the closely cropped head of Vankin, the assistant school instructor, appeared in the doorway.
"Whom have you been kissing here?" "Ah, very good. Sergei Kapitonich, a fine old man indeed. With the female sex, tete-a-tete." "I wasn't kissing at all," said Akinyeev, confused. "Who told you, you fool?"
"I merely smacked my lips on account of... in consideration of my pleasure at the sight of the fish."
"Tell that to someone else, not to me,"
exclaimed Vankin, whose face expanded into a broad smile as he disappeared behind the door. Akinyeev blushed.
"The devil knows what may be the outcome of this," he thought. "He'll go about tittle-tattling now, the rascal. He'll disgrace me before the whole town, the brute."
Akinyeev entered the parlour timidly, casting about furtive glances to see what Vankin was doing. Vankin stood near the piano, and, deftly bending down, whispered something to the inspector's sister-in-law, who was laughing.
"That's about me," thought Akinyeev. "About me, the devil take him! She believes him, she's laughing! My God! No, that mustn't be left like that. No, I'll have to fix it so that no one shall believe him. I'll speak to all of them, and in the end he'll seem like a foolish gossip."
Akinyeev scratched his head and walked up to Padakwa.
"I was in the kitchen a little while ago, arranging things for the supper," he said to the Frenchman. "You like fish, I know, and I have a sturgeon just so big. About 2 yards. Ha ha ha. Yes, yes. By the way, I had almost forgotten. There was a real anecdote about that sturgeon in the kitchen. I entered the kitchen a little while ago and wanted to examine the food. I glanced at the sturgeon and, for pleasure, I smacked my lips. It was so piquant. And just at that moment the fool Vankin entered and says, 'Ah-ha-ha! Ah-ha! You have been kissing here! With Martha!' Oh, just think of it! With the cook! What a piece of invention, that blockhead! The woman is so ugly she looks like a baboon. And he says we were kissing. What an odd fellow!"
"Who's an odd fellow?" asked Tarantulov as he approached them.
"I refer to Vankin. I went out into the kitchen.
The story of Martha and the sturgeon was repeated.
That makes me laugh. What an odd fellow he is. In my opinion, it's more pleasant to kiss the dog than to kiss Martha, added Akinyev,
and turning round, he noticed Mazdar.
We have been speaking about Vankin, he said to him.
What an odd fellow. He entered the kitchen and noticed me standing beside Martha, and immediately he began to invent different stories.
What, he says, have you been kissing each other?
He was drunk, so he must have been dreaming.
And I said, I would rather kiss a duck than kiss Martha. And I have a wife, said I. You fool! He made me appear ridiculous.
Who made you appear ridiculous? Inquired the teacher of religion, addressing Akinyev.
Vankin, I was standing in the kitchen, you know, and looking at the sturgeon.
In about half an hour, all the guests knew the story about Vankin and the sturgeon.
Now let him tell, thought Akinyev, rubbing his hands. Let him do it. He'll start to tell them and they'll cut him short. Don't talk nonsense, you fool. We know all about it.
And Akinyev felt so much appeased that, for joy, he drank 4 glasses of brandy over and above his fill. Having escorted his daughter to her room, he went to his own, and soon slept the sleep of an innocent child, and by the following day he no longer remembered the story of the sturgeon. But alas, man proposes, and God disposes. The evil tongue does its wicked work, and even Akinyev's cunning did not do him any good. A week later, on a Wednesday, after the 3rd lesson, when Akinyev stood in the teacher's room and discussed the vicious inclinations of the pupil Vysyekin, the director approached him, and, beckoning to him, called him aside.
"See here, Sergei Kapitonich," said the director. "Pardon me, it isn't my affair, yet I must make it clear to you nevertheless. It is my duty. You see, rumours are afoot that you are on intimate terms with that woman, with your cook. It isn't my affair, but you may be on intimate terms with her, you may kiss her, you may do whatever you like, but please don't do it so openly. I beg of you, don't forget that you are an educator."
Akinyev stood as though frozen and petrified.
Like one stung by a swarm of bees and scalded with boiling water, he went home. On his way, it seemed to him as though the whole town stared at him as at one smeared with tar.
At home, new troubles awaited him.
"Why aren't you eating anything?" asked his wife at dinner. "What are you thinking about? Are you thinking about Cupid, eh? You're longing for Marfushka. I know everything already, you swine. Kind people have opened my eyes, you barbarian!"
And she slapped him on the cheek. He rose from the table, and staggering without cap or coat, directed his footsteps towards Vankin. The latter was at home.
"You rascal," he said to Vankin, "why have you covered me with mud before the whole world? Why have you slandered me?"
"What slander? What are you inventing?
And who told everybody I was kissing Martha? Not you, perhaps. Not you, you murderer!"
Vankin began to blink his eyes, and all the fibres of his face began to quiver. He lifted his eyes towards the icon in the corner and exclaimed,
"May God punish me! May I lose my eyesight and die if I said even a single word about you to anyone! May I have neither house nor home!"
Vankin's sincerity admitted of no doubt.
It was evident it was not he who had gossiped. "But who was it? Who?" Akinyev asked himself, going over in his mind all his acquaintances and beating his chest.
"Who was it?" he wondered, utterly perplexed.
That was The Slanderer by Anton Chekhov. Translated by Herman Bernstein. Adapted by Nicholas Melbrew. And read by Michael Robert Brown. A Work of Art by Anton Chekhov. Translated by Constance Garnett and read by Michael Robert Brown. A Work of Art. Sasha Smirnov, the only son of his mother, holding under his arm something wrapped up in issue 223 of the Financial News, assumed a sentimental expression and went into Dr. Koshelkov's consulting room.
"Ah, dear lad," was how the doctor greeted him. "Well, how are we feeling? What good news have you for me?"
Sasha blinked, laid his hand on his heart, and said in an agitated voice, "Mama sends her greetings to you, Ivan Nikolaevich, and told me to thank you. I am the only son of my mother, and you have saved my life. You have brought me through a dangerous illness, and we do not know how to thank you."
"Nonsense, lad," said the doctor, highly delighted. "I only did what anyone else would have done in my place."
"I am the only son of my mother. We are poor people and cannot, of course, repay you, and we are quite ashamed, doctor, although, however, Mama and I, the only son of my mother, earnestly beg you to accept, in token of our gratitude, this object, which, an object of great value, an antique bronze, a rare work of art."
"You shouldn't have," said the doctor, frowning. "What's this for?"
No, please do not refuse," Sasha went on, muttering, as he unpacked the parcel. "You will wound Mama and me by refusing. It's a fine thing, an antique bronze. It was left to us by my deceased father, and we have kept it as a precious souvenir. My father used to buy antique bronzes and sell them to connoisseurs. Mama and I run the business now." Sasha undid the object and put it solemnly on the table. It was a not very tall candelabra of old bronze and artistic workmanship. It consisted of a group. On the pedestal stood two female figures in the costume of Eve, and in attitudes for the description of which I have neither the courage nor the fitting temperament. The figures were smiling coquettishly, and altogether looked as though, had it not been for the necessity of supporting the candlestick, they would have skipped off the pedestal and indulged in such an orgy of lewdness, dear listener, as would be quite improper for me to describe. Looking at the gift, the doctor slowly scratched behind his ear, cleared his throat, and blew his nose distractedly.
"Yes, it certainly is a fine thing," he muttered. "But how should I express it? It's not quite for family viewing. It's not simply décolleté, but beyond anything, dash it all."
"How do you mean?"
"The serpent tempter himself could not have invented anything worse. Why, to put such a phantasmagoria on the table would be defiling the whole flat."
"What a strange way of looking at art, doctor," said Sasha, offended. "Why, it is an artistic object. Look at it. There's so much beauty and elegance that it fills one's soul with a feeling of reverence and brings a lump to one's throat. When one sees anything so beautiful, one forgets everything earthly. Just look! Such movements, such atmosphere, such expression!"
"I understand all that very well, my dear boy," the doctor interposed. "But, you know, I am a married man, a family man. My children run in here, ladies come in."
"Of course, if you look at it with the eye of the rabble," said Sasha, "then this exquisitely artistic work may appear in a certain light, but, doctor, elevate yourself above the hoi polloi, especially as you will wound Mama and me by refusing it.
I am the only son of my mother. You have saved my life. We are giving you the thing most precious to us, and I only regret that I have not the pair to present to you."
"Thank you, my dear fellow. Honestly, I am very grateful. Give my respects to your mother, but really consider, my children play in here. Ladies come."
"However, let it remain. I see there is no arguing with you."
"And there is nothing to argue about," said Sasha, relieved. "You can put the candlestick here, by this vase. Such a pity we do not have the pair to it. Such a pity. Well, goodbye, doctor." After Sasha's departure, the doctor looked for a long time at the candelabra, scratched behind his ear, and ruminated. "It's a superb piece, there's no denying it," he thought, "and it would be a shame to throw it away, but it's impossible for me to keep it. What a conundrum. To whom can I make a present of it, or to what charity can I give it?" After long cogitation, he recalled his good friend, the lawyer Uhoff, to whom he was indebted for the management of some legal business. "Excellent," the doctor decided. "It would be awkward for him as a friend to take money from me, and it will be very suitable for me to present him with this. I will take him the devilish thing. He, luckily, is a bachelor, and rather liberal." No sooner thought than done. The doctor put on his hat and coat, took the candelabra, and headed off to Uhoff's. "How are you, my friend?" he said, finding the lawyer at home. "I've come to see you, to thank you for your efforts. You won't take money, so you must at least accept this thing here. See, my dear fellow, the thing is magnificent." On seeing the bronze, the lawyer was moved to indescribable delight. "What a specimen!" he chuckled. "Ah, deuce take it, to think of them imagining such a thing, the devils! Exquisite! Ravishing! Where did you get hold of such a delightful thing?" But having poured out his ecstasies, the lawyer looked timidly towards the door and said, "Only you must take back your present, old chap. I can't accept it." "Why?" cried the doctor, disconcerted. "Why? Why, because my mother is often here. I have clients. Besides, I should be embarrassed if my servants saw it." "Nonsense, nonsense! Don't you dare to refuse," said the doctor, gesticulating. "It's churlish of you. It's a work of art. Such movement, such expression! I won't even talk of it. You will offend me. Perhaps one could plaster over it, or stick on fig leaves." But the doctor gesticulated more violently than before, and, dashing out of the flat, went home, only too glad that he had succeeded in getting the present off his hands. When he had gone, the lawyer examined the candelabra, fingered it all over, and then, like the doctor, racked his brains over the question what to do with the gift. "It's a fine thing," he mused, "and it would be a pity to throw it away and improper to keep it. The very best thing would be to make a present of it to someone. I know what. I'll take it this evening to Sashkin, the comedian. The rascal is fond of such things, and it happens to be his benefit tonight." No sooner thought than done. In the evening, the candelabra, carefully wrapped up, was duly carried to Sashkin's. The whole evening the comic actor's dressing-room was besieged by men coming to admire the present. The dressing-room was filled with the hum of enthusiasm and laughter like the neighing of horses. If one of the actresses approached the door and asked, "May I come in?" the comedian's husky voice was heard at once, "No, no, my dear, I am not dressed." After the performance, though, the comedian shrugged his shoulders, flung up his hands, and said, "Well, what am I to do with the horrid thing? Why, I live in a private flat. Actresses come and see me. It's not as if it's a photograph that you can hide in a drawer." "You had better sell it, sir," the hairdresser who was disrobing the actor advised him. "There's an old woman living around here who buys antique bronzes. Go and inquire for Mrs. Smirnova. Everyone knows her." The actor followed his advice. 2 days later, the doctor was sitting in his consulting room, and with his finger to his brow, was meditating on the acids of the bile. All at once, the door opened and Sasha Smirnov flew into the room. He was smiling, beaming, his whole figure radiant with happiness. In his hands, he held something wrapped up in newspaper.
"Doctor," he began breathlessly, "imagine my delight. Happily for you, we have succeeded in picking up the pair to your candelabra. Mamma is so happy. I am the only son of my mother. You saved my life."
And Sasha, all of a tremor with gratitude, set the candelabra before the doctor.
The doctor opened his mouth, tried to say something, but said nothing. He was speechless. That was A Work of Art by Anton Chekhov, translated by Constance Garnett, and read by Michael Robert Brown.
Arbury, drama and fiction. Hear more drama and fiction, old and new, on arburyproductions.co.uk.